Angie's List is now Angie, and we've heard a lot of theories about why.
I thought it was an eco move. Fewer words, less paper.
No, it was so you could say it faster.
No, it's to be more iconic.
Must be a tech thing.
But those aren't quite right. It's because now you can compare upfront prices, book a service instantly, and even get your project handled from start to finish.
Sounds easy.
It is, and it makes us so much more than just a list. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I. Or download the app today.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
Content warning. This episode contains discussion of violence and murder.
On November 29th, 2004, an armored truck guard named Robert Keith Palomares was loading up an AMC Theaters deposits in Phoenix. It was a routine run, until it wasn't. A gunman ambushed and murdered the 24-year-old, running off with around $56,000. Fingerprints from the scene matched a man named Jason Derek Brown. Those who knew Brown were shocked. They'd believed him to be a hard-partying surfer dude and a successful and charming businessman. A true embodiment of the American dream. But as it turned out, Brown was a con artist, a criminal so intent on living the high life that he'd kill to keep up appearances.
Brown became a fugitive from justice and remains one today. His car was discovered at the Portland International Airport. It's possible that he got out of the country and went abroad, although it's also possible that he just went underground here in the United States. Until recently, he was on the Federal Bureau of Investigation's 10 Most Wanted list. The FBI believes that Brown is still out there, still hiding. We'll include a link to his FBI poster in our show notes. Take a look. Study his face.
We just passed the 18th anniversary of the day Brown killed Palomares in cold blood. To mark that, we're running an interview we did recently about this case.
We talked with Matthew Gentile. He's the writer and director of a 2022 film called American Murderer. It's a fictionalized film that's rooted in the true story of Brown and his crimes. You can watch it pretty much wherever you stream movies online, including Amazon, iTunes, and Google Play Movies.
Back in October, we talked with Matthew about how he became obsessed with Brown's case and how he eventually translated that into a script and a film project. We discussed the intricacies of the case, about this con man turned killer, and we delved into the nuances of some recent discourse in the true crime space around movies based on real crimes.
If you've ever wondered how a true crime-based film gets made, or even envisioned yourself working on such a project, this is a must-listen.
My name is Anya Kane. I'm a journalist.
And I'm Kevin Greenlee. I'm an attorney.
We first connected while looking into the Burger Chef murders, an Indiana cold case. Together, we built a spreadsheet documenting hundreds of cases of restaurant-related homicides. That original spreadsheet gave way to our podcast, The Murder Sheet.
Now we maintain that same research-centric, investigative approach as we look into all sorts of homicides, including unsolved cases, historical crimes, and, of course, restaurant murders.
We don't just chat about the headlines. Our podcast is a platform for our journalism. The Murder Sheet focuses on investigative reporting, thoughtful analysis, thorough research, and in-depth interviews. We're The Murder Sheet, and this is a conversation with American murderer director Matthew Gentile. I guess to start off with, maybe tell us a bit about your background and sort of how you came to work on the American Murderer Project.
So the story goes, before I wanted to be a filmmaker, I wanted to be an FBI agent. So I was 14 years old when this crime that American Murderer is based on and character was committed by Jason Derrick Brown. So most of your listeners already probably know the crime was committed November 29, 2004. Jason Derrick Brown was a charismatic con man who robbed an armored truck, killed a guard, took off with a bag of $60,000, has never been seen or heard from since. So 14-year-old me was obsessed with the FBI's top 10 list. I used to go on the FBI.gov. I would look at their fugitives posters, and I would try to see if I could help them catch one. You know, that was my juvenile fantasy. So I became really intrigued by Jason because I saw his face on this list. You know, you had a sea of menacing faces from Osama bin Laden to Whitey Bulger, and really sophisticated, high-end criminal masterminds. And then you have this surfer dude from Southern California, and something just doesn't really fit the bill. So his face stood out to me. Cut to 14 years later, I was graduating from film school at the American Film Institute, AFI. I was struggling to figure out what my first feature was. You know, I had a couple short films I had made that had done pretty well for me and opened a lot of doors in the industry, but I couldn't really figure out what that first feature was, how to make that leap. And as I was figuring out, I was kind of hopping around from different story to different story. And then all of a sudden, Jason's face popped up on my television. I was storyboarding one day for a shoot, and his face showed up. And I said to myself, is this guy really still missing? So I turned the volume up and I watched this doc, you know, because Jason's story has been covered quite widely. It's been on American Greed, Dateline, you know, lots of newspaper articles. There was a lot of information about him out there and images that Jason had made of himself. Like he had photographed himself a lot with his shirt off in front of his Cadillac, or, you know, made like videos of himself throwing boat parties, which we see in the film, you know, we kind of recreate. So there was a lot out there about him. And I just kind of asked myself, I was like, well, A, how did this guy outlast all these people? But also, like, how did he kind of get away with what he did? And what I realized as I started to research it was this was a con man who had a really good way of, you know, like a lot of good con artists, had a way of like preying on people's confidence, right? And using them and making them fall in love with them or fall for their lies. But there was a really interesting paradox because he clearly meant a lot to different people. He was loved by a lot of people. He loved some people. So I just found this web that he left behind in this aftermath really, really fascinating. And so I began to ask myself, well, what if this was a movie, the story? And, it seemed a little ambitious for a first-time director. So I thought maybe I would just write the script and see if I could sell it or something like that. But as I started writing it and researching it, I just became so fascinated and obsessed that I just said, yeah, this has to be my first movie. And, I was fortunate that I did a proof of concept short of the script. I shot one scene from it, the SWAT invasion in the movie. Spoiler, there's a SWAT invasion. I shot that 5-minute scene that got the attention of a couple different producers and companies, Kevin Matisau, Chris Appel, Gia Walsh. They came on, they opted my script. We developed it for about a year, and then we went ahead and, you know, got this thing made. So it was quite a journey. It took a few years, and, you know, as movies, independent films, you know, it's a miracle any of them get made today. And we made this movie, you know, just to give you some perspective, in the height of the pandemic. We shot November, December 2020. So it was a really, like, crazy time to be making a movie, and especially with this incredible cast. So, yeah, it was quite a journey. But essentially, the short answer is I wrote my way into the director's chair. And there's no one way to become a director, but, you know, writing your own script and not letting anyone else direct it is one that's been proven for some to work. So
worked out for you, yet you staked your claim and you stuck with it.
Exactly.
I'm curious, tell me more about the research process, you know, going into a crime, because you're having to deal with it. You know, it's not a documentary. You're scripting a real life crime. So what sort of research goes into that? And what are you looking at as you're researching in order to say, how can I depict this whole situation?
For sure. And, you know, every project has different needs. You know, my next four scripts I'm doing are all true crime. So I love the genre. I'm here to stay. But, you know, for American Murderer, because this was really my first time doing a true story and a true crime film, I actually spent about 6 months, like, first, before even writing a page, just researching, where I did conduct interviews. I'm not going to name who, because I don't want to out them, but we'll just say people who knew these people, who know some of the people in the film. Some characters are composites, so they're not fully, like, a real person, but, you know, I interviewed people who knew them. I didn't interview the cops or the FBI who worked the case, because it's still an open investigation, so I didn't have that ability. But I did talk to police officers and brought them information about the case. It's like, can you tell me what's up here? I did get my hands on every file, thing, image of him I could. I was able to get access to some of, like, you know, what we talked about, like, video footage of him partying and drinking and hanging out on his boat with his friends, which was really insightful and hilarious and wild. And, you know, I was able to really research the crime in depth. Like, I got crime scene files and all that kind of stuff that was open to the public. So the answer is I did everything I could publicly, right, to get. And then at a certain point, you know, research is a really great way for a screenwriter. And I'm sure you might feel similarly as a true crime content creator. It's great, but there's also a great way to procrastinate from actually doing the work. You know, you can amass a lot of knowledge and you know the world so well, but then you got to start writing. And so for me, you know, I was never really personally, I didn't feel that beholden to tell it accurately. I was more pursuing an emotional truth and honesty, if that makes any sense. So I was really trying to, you know, get to the truth of what these characters feel like. What did it feel like to be Jason's sister in that moment, when, you know, she finds out he did this, right? So that's kind of more what I was pursuing, rather than like, well, actually, you know, there was a neighbor across the street who saw everything or called them, you know. So I was really trying to pursue the emotional truth and honesty. I wasn't necessarily pursuing accuracy for this film, but I did do a ton of research, which really helped inform creative decisions. Things down to, like, say, the wardrobe Jason wears in the film, like that striped green shirt. You know, that's ridiculous. It's a shirt we saw pictures of him wearing, you know, in a club, but photos of him, he took of himself in a club, or, you know, like the beau party, the types of, you know, people he had on that party, we were able to, like, you know, pull from that. So we have a lot, or, you know, the bike he uses in the murder, like, was painted the same exact color. So things like that, where we really, like, you know, because what I want to do as a filmmaker, ultimately, and I think you also probably feel this way as to running a podcast, is you want to immerse your viewer or your listener. You want to immerse them in the world you're creating. And the beauty of film, you know, that we have at our disposal is we have tons of tools. You know, we have visuals, we have sound, we have music, we have all that. And so really getting as much research as I could on it was great. But then ultimately I felt the freedom to be able to go off and try things and make up stuff to make it more dramatic and compelling. Because real life, as we know, often does not play out like a movie, right? There's just too many slow parts or whatever. So, you know, there was a lot of creative liberties I had to take. And that's also why I should clear for the record here that I never spoke to the family of Jason Derrick Brown in the making of the film, because I didn't want my take on Jason to be filtered through that lens. So I wanted to remain kind of objective in the process, because, again, this is a work of true crime fiction, right? It's true crime. There's a lot of true stuff. But there's people who know a lot about the case and have told me, they said they're amazed by how accurate it is. And I've, some things are like, yeah, that was intentional. And some things I'm like, oh, all right, that was, you know, it's sort of like, cool. But you know, yeah, no, I try to research as much as I can. You know, things like the crime, like the murder sequence itself is pretty well researched and close, you know, to how it happened from what I gathered. But, you know, there's a lot we created.
You mentioned the emotional truth of the movie. If you could boil it down, you know, what is sort of the underpinning emotional thread that goes through the film as far as you see it, for, you know, what it meant to be involved and wrapped up in this whole situation, you know, created by Mr. Brown, and what is the kind of truth for you? I know at the ending, it's, you know, this kind of ambiguous
right
ending, obviously, because of how real life plays out. He becomes a fugitive and he's still out there. But for you, sort of what is that emotional truth, if you could speak to that?
Well, you know, films are funny because some movies are what they call message movies, right? Where you watch a movie, it has a specific message. And as you pointed out, this film has an ambiguous ending. Like, it doesn't, you know, this movie does not deliver a cookie cutter, like, hey, you know, con artists are bad, right? We already knew that, really. So, you know, the movie, to me, the reason why I made it is because I think it poses a question, you know, which is, there's a couple. One is, why do we fall for con artists? Right. I think that's something the film's really exploring, is because people like Jason, you know, Jason's not a standalone. There's a lot of people out there like him, unfortunately, you know, and that, you know, you have, there's, I don't want to compare exactly, but like, look at Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos, or look at the Firefest guys, you know, scams. Now, they're not murderers, but their scams are a huge part of our culture, or Anna Delvey, right? You have this kind of thing going on in the American zeitgeist, specifically. Not con artists are all over the world, but in America, it's a very specific thing. So I really wanted to explore that. Why do we keep falling for con men? And how do, you know, and it's not an indictment or judgment on any of the characters in the movie, but I noticed as I was like looking at this, that a lot of people, when they found out what Jason Derek Brown did, were completely shocked and awestruck. Like, it was like, how did this guy do this? How could he have done? No way. That's not the Jason I know. I heard that a lot, right? That's not the Jason I know. And so I don't think really anyone in the film is a dumb person. I think actually every character is pretty smart and independent, or, you know, like, I just think that what they ended up unfortunately doing, that I think a lot of us do, is they kind of, you know, it's like almost like they were blinding themselves to the ugly nature that was kind of right there, because we don't want to admit that, right? And so I think that's what, you know, the film is really unpacking and exploring, because, you know, Jason Derek Brown was, you know, perhaps he was just born a bad egg, right? And we do show scenes where, you know, you explain how he might have gotten coached by his father, and right, his father was also a con man who also disappeared, so there was a lot of teaching. He was taught things that, you know, certainly I would guess you and I were not taught, right, as kids. So, you know, I think exploring that and unpacking that and understanding, like, all right, here's this guy, let me show him to you, present you Jason Derek Brown through all of these multiple perspectives, so that whether you love this guy or hate him, right, or fall anywhere in between. And I've had audience members go all over the spectrum. I've had some people say they were rooting for him until they find out what he did. I've had some people say they were against him from the get-go, but they were kind of like wanting to see what would happen, you know. And I think however you feel, you can still enjoy the film, because ultimately, by the end of the movie, you're going to get a 360-degree panoramic view of who this guy was. You know, you're going to see him in all his colors, all the, you know, the good stuff, part, the good elements about him, which is that, like, he was good with kids, and he was, you know, a nice boyfriend sometimes, and, you know, whatever, and he was a good brother, or seemed like it. You know, then you see the bad parts, which are that he's using pretty much everybody and seeing all of them as a personal credit card, and calculating and cunning and, you know, dishonest and all that, right? But you get all of that, so that by the end of it, you come out and you're like, how do we deal with this kind of person in our society? How do we deal with a murderer, a sociopath, right? Because, you know, a sociopath doesn't see themselves necessarily as a sociopath. You know, Jason Derek Brown doesn't wake up in the morning probably and go, oh, I'm a real sociopath, I'm going to do something evil today. No, in his brain, he's just like, if I do this, I'll get that. If I use that woman, I'll get to stay in her house for 2 weeks. If I, you know, commit this crime, I'll be able to get my boat back. And it's that mindset that's really unsettling, but I think relevant. So, you know, I really wanted to examine this guy and you know, bring him into the light and help us, you know, confront the audience and ask questions that might make them a little uncomfortable, but I think also will be intriguing, compelling, and entertainment.
I'm curious, you know, in terms of Brown in particular, you mentioned a couple of other sort of scams and con artists that have occurred, and having done this portrait essentially of Brown and the person that, you know, he was and how he was acting, do you have any thoughts on what prompted him to take that step further in terms of not just running cons, but actually crossing the line into, right, you know, taking another person's life and becoming a murderer?
Yeah, you know, there's, it's actually really interesting because the movie mostly takes place in the year of the crime and the murder, right? So, you know, you get flashbacks of different parts, but it's most, the majority of it is in that year. And that year actually is the most mysterious one of Jason's life. Like between Jason moving into this neighborhood where in the film, the character is portrayed by Idina Menzel and her son, like, you know, before he kind of moves into this neighborhood, because Jason's scam, just for the listeners out there, you know, his normal scam was he would kind of move into a neighborhood. He'd come with all these flashy, fancy toys, you know, Cadillacs, BMWs, boats. He'd move into a house, lease it, you know, and he kind of looked like, on the surface, a successful young bro-y business guy, you know, who was like just well off and cool and fun and would take the, you know, take the guys to the bar and hit on the girl. You know, he just had this kind of like, yeah, big man on campus vibe to him. And he would do this for like 3 to 6 months before a creditor would be onto him. And then he'd go and move to the next thing and move to the next scam. You know, I think it came from a few things. One was, you know, as, and the movie does kind of show this, you know, he couldn't really keep that scam going anymore. Like his scams, his normal ways of getting money were not working for him anymore. He couldn't quite pull it off. And so, you know, in a way, it's a bit of a twisted addiction movie in that Jason was addicted to a certain lifestyle. He wanted to have wealth. He wanted to have extravagance. He wanted to have the toys. He wanted to be the big shot, but he didn't want to actually work for it. Right. And so I think in Jason Derek Brown's brain, which was a dangerous place, he was desperate. You know, I think he came at it from a place of desperation, and that's twisted because really, like, it wasn't that desperate, right? Like, you know, he could have given the toys back, sold it, maybe did 2 years in prison for whatever petty crimes he committed and been done, right? That would have been the healthy choice if such a thing existed. But instead, he decided to go down the spiral. And, you know, for the year leading up to the murder, that's the most mysterious year in Jason's life. People don't really know where he went or what he was doing. You know, in my film, I have dramatized that with thugs who were on his trail. And he did owe money to thugs. So that wasn't in real life. That was actually a true thing. So I used that. But, you know, in terms of the timing, we're not sure when that happened. But, you know, he was in the underworld and he was, you know, I think he was spending a lot of time alone, you know, letting his mind spiral with bad ideas, and ultimately it just escalated and escalated further and further, you know, to the point where he did something truly unthinkable. But you know, yeah, it is quite a jump to go from petty cons to first degree murder and armed robbery. And you know, this is one of the reasons that it's, you know, I'll never get to sit down with Jason Derek Brown and ask him why he did what he did, but I saw it as, well, from my interpretation as a filmmaker, my interpretation was he was just getting inside. His head was just going out of control with desperation of, I have to get back to this high life. I have to get back to being that big man on campus. And so he was chasing that high he had, you know, much like an addiction.
At The Murder Sheet, we're all about immersive audio experiences.
That's why we love Audible. An Audible subscription gives you access to thousands of audiobook titles. We especially enjoy their robust selection of mysteries, thrillers, and true crime.
I love Audible. I've really enjoyed listening to A Wicked Snow by Greg Olson. This story is all about a CSI investigator with a dark past and a terrible family secret. When I'm listening to Audible, it plunks me right down in the middle of the story. It's so spine-tingling that I can practically feel the cold air on my skin. Audible is your one-stop destination for thrillers and mysteries. Just be prepared to get spooked in the best possible way.
Listening to audiobooks offers a wonderful respite from the day. Audible allows you to listen on the go. I love taking a walk or a drive and just getting lost in a story. My favorite audiobook on Audible so far is Presumed Innocent, the book track edition. This classic legal thriller by Scott Turow is enhanced by a gripping musical soundtrack that amplifies the story's suspense and profound emotional beats.
As a new member, you can try out Audible for free for 30 days. This is such a valuable membership, and you get access to so many new listening experiences, including podcasts, Audible originals, and Audible exclusives, like the Words Plus Music series.
Visit audible.com/msheet or text msheet to 500-500.
What makes a life a good one? Is it the adventure you have? Or the friends you find along the way? Maybe it's pursuing your passion while striving to protect, defend, and save what you believe in every single day. So, what makes a life a good one? In the Coast Guard, we think it's all of the above and more. But you'll have to find out for yourself. Visit GoCoastGuard.com to learn more.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Yeah, it certainly sounds like it. And you know, I mean, in terms of the murder, 2004, Robert Keith Palomares being the, 24-year-old armored car guard that he murdered. I know you can't, if you can't get into your sources, no worries. Were you able to connect with his family or, friends or anyone like that who was able to give you some info on the man that he ended up murdering?
Well, I didn't connect with the family of either Palomares or Jason Dark Brown for the same reason that I didn't want my take influenced. You know, there were articles, interviews on those documentaries that did interview the victim's family and Jason's family, not so much in the documentaries, but in interviews and articles. Yeah. So I had what I needed, I felt. And I had learned about Palomares that, you know, he was reportedly just a nice guy and a young man, and portraying that incident, we made sure to, show, it's the hard part of this movie, right? And sometimes the hard part to talk about because, and the constant conflict that happens with true crime storytelling, you never make a movie like this to exacerbate anyone's pain. Like, that's never something we would intend to do. But I think we unfortunately have to show that scene, right? Because you have to show all the things Jason Derek Brown did and to give that 360-degree view and portrait of who he was. But yes, there was information on Robert Keith Palomares that I had that he was, a nice, upstanding guy who, suffered a really unfortunate tragedy at the hands of this, of Jason Derek Brown.
Absolutely. If you could explain to the listeners, I guess, why is it important for a filmmaker to possibly maintain that separation of church and state when it comes to not being too influenced about the characters that you're kind of, whose story you're sort of fictionalizing, but, staying true to at the same time? And sort of how does that factor into a filmmaker's thinking about like, okay, how can I do this story justice?
Right. Well, let's put it this way. In the case of, say, the Palomares family, the character of Robert Palomares is not portrayed much in the film, right? It's a very small part of the movie, which is intentional. So, in terms of the information needed, that was all we had, what we needed for that, to show them, to make the point we were trying to make, that what Jason did was a horrible thing to an innocent person. In terms of someone like Jason Derek Brown, when you're making a movie about him, but I think it would be the case if you were doing any biopic, whether it's about Steve Jobs or, Jake LaMotta, the subject of Raging Bull, Jake LaMotta famously was suing Scorsese and De Niro when the movie came out because he didn't like the way he was portrayed. You know, real life characters and movie characters might look similar, but they're often very different. You know, they're not really, like, I think it's kind of funny when like movies end and you show a picture. They always show it. We didn't do this in the movie, but you show a picture of the real person and people are like, oh my God, they looked exactly like them. And I personally never really care when that happens. Like, I'm kind of like, okay, you know, like, how was the actor? Was the actor good? You know? But I think that it's important. You know, the way I would phrase it is, let's say somebody was making a movie about your life, right? You know, someone wanted to make a biopic about you from age 5 to 25, right? And, you know, tell me this, if they interviewed your mom, how would that screenwriter be able to do their job? Because your mom is going to say, well, she's the best person in the world. I love her so much. And she's this and that. And, you know, she was a sweet kid. And like, you know, because that's what parents and family do. They, you know, they're going to want their family to be portrayed a certain way. And look, I wasn't even trying to make the movie to, you know, I didn't approach the character of Jason Derek Brown with judgment, I don't feel, you know. And I don't think Tom, who portrayed him, I think, perfectly. I don't think Tom did either, because if Tom did, and if I did, I think it wouldn't really worked. You know, we were really just trying to show you someone for who they are, right? And in an unflinching way. And I think that, you know, look, some films do talk to the people they portray. So there's no one blanket rule. Anybody can do it anyway. I just, for my own film, you know, I wanted to maintain that objectivity. But I don't think there's a right or wrong answer, you know?
That makes sense.
Yeah. It is tricky when you're dealing with real life people. You know, there's a famous story of one of my favorite movies, Dog Day Afternoon, the real Al Pacino's real character apparently like got beat up in prison for some stuff that was in the movie and complained about it. And the screenwriter wrote a letter in a newspaper saying, okay, I'm sorry. He didn't actually do these things. I made it up. This is what filmmakers do. Just leave him alone. And eventually then they stopped. So, you know, sometimes there are things like that that's funny. But yeah, no, I mean, I think that it is a tricky thing. But that said, you know, I think that filmmakers, true crime content creators, I know a lot of true crime content creators often get in trouble with families, victims or things like that. And I think that it's a challenging line to walk. But I think that these stories should be told because they can help us examine our culture and our world and why I think these kinds of things happen. You know, I actually happen to think that despite the rap true crime gets as being kind of grim and this and that, there's a lot of studies on how people who are really into true crime it's an indication of empathy because people want to know why this happened and, you know, how that happened. And I think that's a good thing. So, you know, but it is a tricky juggling act. And we're all, you know, it's something I think as the genre becomes more and more popular, because it's become insanely popular now, good thing for us, you know, it is a tricky thing we're going to be, you know, figuring out in years to come.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask, and this has kind of become part of the online discourse recently, but it's also one of those things where sometimes there's a difference between the online discourse and the audience, you know, the overall audience, you know, out there regarding true crime. And I'm speaking specifically about one film, the recent Dahmer project that ran, you know, sort of, you saw on the one hand, very popular, you know, project. People were definitely, I think it did numbers. At the same time, it was getting critiqued in some circles for, you know, do we need another Dahmer film or you know, people who were family members of the victims being upset with the way things were portrayed. And I guess like as you know, as a filmmaker sort of in the same space, like let's kind of adapt and fictionalize a true story while remaining true to it, but, you know, treating it, you know, like a work of true crime fiction, I think, as you mentioned. How do you look at that discourse and how do you sort of interpret that and say, like, is the audience shifting on what they want from true crime? Or is this a matter of like, it's just one thread and perhaps it's maybe a bit smaller than it looks to people who are very online on Twitter, I guess.
You ask very smart, thoughtful questions, I just want to say. So thank you for doing
my
that.
Job.
it helps. It's a great question. You know, I haven't seen Dahmer, so I can't speak too much to it. The funny thing is I don't for someone who does true crime, I don't watch a ton of true crime because I watch some, but I'm not like seeking it all the time because, you know, I like to take.
I'm the same way.
Yeah, exactly.
We take breaks. Yeah.
We take breaks from our work. You know, but as far as like, well, from what I could see from the outside, I could see both sides. You know, I can understand why a victim's family would be upset. I can understand why they might be upset by my film, you know, the victim's family in this movie. And if they are, I'm sure they are, you know. I think that, you know, it is a challenging thing. That said, you know, my feeling on it is do we need another Dahmer story? I don't know. I mean, I did see part of actually the first episode and I did think it was quite powerful because I was so unsettled by it, I had to turn it off. I just couldn't, oof. You know, it really, really was, and I thought it looked quite good to me. And Evan Peters, I think, seems like he really is giving a great performance in that show. That's me saying it after watching like 25 minutes of it. But he looked amazing in it and like looks like he really got him. You know, I don't know. I mean, I think that it's obvious. I mean, look, I think the fact that so many people tuned in to watch it does say something, that people want to know about this, that people are interested, that people, you know, and I think I like Ryan Murphy's shows. I really like the Versace show that he did. I thought that was great. And I like the OJ show that they did. I thought that was great. And I liked the impeachment one. The one with Monica Lewinsky and Sarah Paulson, I thought that was also excellent because I think they're examining these things that happened and have truth and have, you know, yes, they're dramatizations, but I think dramatizations of true events, what they can ultimately do, and this goes all the way back to sound pretentious, but to Shakespeare, right, is they kind of help you make, or Aristotle, right? I mean, we're making order of this weird, fucked up world we live in. Right. And that's what I think all drama can do, not just true crime, but true crime especially, I think. And so, you know, I understand why. And again, I can't speak. I don't know exactly what the families are upset about other than the trauma being re-brought up, which I totally get. But at the same time, you know, is that a reason for the show or, you know, movies or TV shows or books or podcasts about true crime to therefore not exist? You know, I don't necessarily think so, because I do think there can be something gained from helping an audience understand who this kind of person was. My guess is Dahmer really explores who he was and what made him tick and, you know, why he became this way and how do we deal with these kinds of monsters? Because, you know, Dahmer's like a monster on a whole other level, but, you know, it was, it's a name everybody knows. So, you know, I don't know. It's an interesting question. And I don't, without having seen all of it, I can't fully answer, but I think that, yeah, I think there's totally valid logic for both schools of thought or all schools of thought in this.
Yeah. I, as a journalist, I tend to say that sunshine and telling stories is tends to be the better move but certainly obviously in some cases I can understand how something could veer into being more exploitative. I didn't see Dahmer, but I certainly can understand why people would want to adapt that story given, you know, the horrific nature of what he did. And so yeah. I think I'm with you. I think I can see it both ways. And I think it's probably just a nuanced thing where filmmakers and true crime creators and true crime consumers have to sort of look at it for themselves and say, you know, just kind of judge a film or a project on its own merits, as opposed to saying, well, we can never do anything on X anymore.
Divisive entertainment's interesting when like that, you know. And I think my movie might be in a similar category where, you know, I think it's like, at least I've seen, like, you know, I think the debates that come, like, you know, you look at movies like Joker, like when Joker came out, like people were pissed about that movie. They really thought it was dangerous and this and that, and ended up just, you know, becoming a very popular movie, right? Or, you know, movies, a lot of films that were like ahead of their time, like you look at A Clockwork Orange or Bonnie and Clyde, even like Bonnie and Clyde pissed people off. People were really like, they're like, you can't do that. You can't show these people having a fun time and, you know, doing what they do. And now they've done it 100 times since. So I don't know, you know, I'm not really, I'm pretty against censorship as a process. Like that's kind of the big thing I hate the most. So, you know, that said, I don't think this is censorship. You know, I think that, yeah, I think we want this kind of stuff. I think there's no harm in art existing because people can make their own interpretations about it, you know?
Yes. And I'm curious, you know, in terms of, it's actually funny, like I've read like collections of like early true crime. And there's that with true crime in particular, like it starts out in the United States in like Puritan tracts being like, look at this bad person, you know, this is why they're going to hell because they're, you know, they did this. And it is that moralizing sort of instruction, but then it converges into more narrative. I just think it's a pendulum that's constantly swinging, and
yeah,
it'll be a conversation that we're having 100 years from now, because
for sure,
it will still occur, and they'll still be, is this too much? Is this too sensationalizing? What's the difference though with your film is that it's about a crime that is technically currently, I wouldn't say it's unsolved, it's just unresolved, because
it is, yeah.
This man is still a fugitive. So you have the public educational element of saying, hey, like this guy's out there. Maybe you should read up on the case and right. Keep an eye out a little bit.
Yeah, you know, Ryan Phillippe on every show has said, let's go catch this guy. Like we can get him, you know, because he's still out there allegedly, you know. And yes, you know, it's kind of funny because like, I didn't make the movie specifically to catch Jason. If it leads to that, I have no problem with that. But that wasn't like my, you know, I don't think that's a reason to make a film. That's a reason to be an FBI agent at 14. But not a reason to make a film. But yeah, you know, it is fascinating that discourse we're having. I mean, it is an interesting time for true crime for sure. And what its power and what it can do.
Absolutely. That's so fun. I think if Ryan Phillippe goes out and catches this guy, that'll have to be a follow-up film.
I know. Yeah. We had some people in our press junket saying sequel. And I'm like, what's the sequel? He's still missing, you know, but if he gets caught, maybe, or if we ever find out what happened to him, but I don't know. I would probably let someone else do the sequel. I think my story is told here.
Do you, I mean, I'm just like, I know the goal of the film is not to catch him, but it certainly, you know, I'm sure helps to raise public awareness.
Right.
Do you have a theory on where he is? Like having been through all this, having told his story, do you have a theory on like, if not where, then like what he's doing or, you know, how he's existing now?
Well, you know, at the production office of the movie, we had a list on the wall because my production had a marker that you could like write on the glass, and everyone had their theory. I think mine was Australia for a while. I thought he was there. You know, the last sighting of him was in 2008 in Salt Lake City, allegedly, although it's not a fully confirmed sighting, but it's a probably confirmed sighting. Like he was apparently seen by a former friend who drove through a stoplight, had like long hair through a red light, and the guy saw him and they recognized each other and he just zoomed through. So it's pretty suspicious, but my guess is he got out of the country. I don't think he stayed around that long. My guess is he went to Australia or somehow got his way through, maybe French speaking to, cause he spoke fluent French, and apparently Spanish. So, you know, a guy speaking French, Spanish, who's charming and has a knack for the underground world and can figure out how to make the right false IDs or identifications, and, you know, in that dark kind of underbelly. Yeah, there's a lot of theories on where he could be. Some people think he reunited with his father. I don't think that's true. I think no one knows where the father went. I think that was just a total disappear story that we'll never know. And I think he's similar. I think he probably figured out a way to hide under the radar. My guess is not live a flashy, ostentatious life anymore. I think that's what he probably gave up, right? Was going around being like seen everywhere, big man on campus. I think he probably slid under the radar. I almost see it like, you know, Better Call Saul. Like what does, you know, Jimmy McGill do when he like lives at the Cinnabon and lives under the radar? I think he's probably living somewhere under the radar. If he's alive at all, there's a possibility he's not. But, you know, if more people see the movie, maybe a conversation will get going and we will find out. It's possible.
Yeah. Yeah. Certainly one would hope. And I'm curious in terms of feedback from any of the law enforcement folks that you mentioned, you know, sort of speaking to, has that been, are they hopeful that it could stir some conversations or anything like that?
I don't know. You know, there was an interesting thing I was listening, because I was also on True Crime Garage this past week. So I've been on
Love the Captain. Absolutely.
Love the Captain. Yeah, they're great. I was on them this week and they were saying it was really interesting that Jason Derrick Brown was taken, because he was just recently taken off the FBI top 10 fugitives list in September on the 7th, actually, right, you know, 4 weeks before this movie or 5 weeks before this movie opened. That was surprising to them because they were like, well, now with a movie coming out and all this like free publicity, right, for their case, wouldn't they still keep him on if this was the time? So it's tough to say because I've never spoken to the FBI about it. They don't talk on ongoing investigations, so I didn't go that route. But I had a really great law enforcement consultant named Adam Richardson. He actually runs a really, really great podcast called the Writer Detectives Bureau, where he's a consultant for films and TV. He was a former. Do you know this? Would you by any chance know the case of Jesse James in Hollywood? It was in the movie Alpha Dog.
Yeah, with Anton. That's a scary case.
Yeah, so Adam Richardson was the detective who worked it. He brought Jesse James Hollywood in. So he was my consultant, and I shared multiple drafts of the screenplay with him. He saw the movie, and when we filmed, actually, I would FaceTime him from set and be like, does this look right? Does that look right? So, you know, he worked me really hard to get as many of the police, FBI procedural elements as right as possible.
That's so cool. Yeah.
He gave me approval. He pointed out a couple things I did wrong. Like I have one scene where these two cop cars are like behind a car and they come out with their guns. And he was like, it looks cool in the movies and it works. But just so you know, they wouldn't actually stage it like that because if the guy ducks, they'll shoot each other. I was like, oh, that makes sense. So that's the one big mistake I made, apparently. But he said it's fine because it looks cool. And that's the thing he always stresses is that sometimes things that, you know, look cool aren't necessarily realistic. So you kind of have to pick your battles. But we tried to be pretty authentic. Like, actually, it was also helpful having Ryan play this character because Ryan actually comes from a military background. His family's military background. And he's played a cop so many times. So he actually was like, when he was holding the gun in the movie, like this, you know, listeners can't see, but it's like pointing down almost at your chest. I was like, what are you doing? Like you gotta go like that. And he was like, no, I don't do that. I do that when I'm ready to draw. Otherwise I'd keep it like this. And I've had a couple cops who've seen it say to me, oh, that's great. Ryan knew how to hold the gun like a real cop. So there you go.
The little moments of realism. And yeah, I think there's sometimes an obsession with people about everything being, you know, hyper realistic or vetted. And I think like there needs to be room in fiction to just have stuff that looks kind of cool. Like not, you know, don't worry about it so much.
You can please some of the people some of the time, but never all the people all the time, you know. There you go. Like that.
We certainly learned that. I'm curious, are there any, I wanted to ask the title of the film, American Murderer, and we kind of touched upon this earlier in the interview, but I wanted to ask you, you know, what about Brown's crimes and him as a person do you think really speaks to sort of America and what makes his story in some ways, you know, uniquely American, obviously, as denoted by the title of the film.
Right. Well, I want to be clear on the record and say this is not an anti-American movie. I'm a very pro-American person. I'm a proud American. You know, the funny thing about the title, you're going to laugh, but the reason it's titled this title is the first time I heard about the case, I Googled Jason Derrick Brown. When you Google Jason Derrick Brown, it says American murderer. Just like if you were to Google my name right now, it'll say American film director, or your name, it would be like American crime podcast author, right? So I found it really interesting, kind of on an intellectual level, that, oh, he does this thing. And now that is what we will know him as for the rest of our lives, is the American murderer. So it kind of stuck. I mean, that said, you know, I think one thing the movie always was about to me is, you know, we have this American dream, which tells you go out, prosper, conquer, manifest your own destiny, right? Get out there and make your fortune, right? Like that's kind of a dream that's advertised that I'm not against. You know, I'm a filmmaker. I'm one of many filmmakers in Hollywood trying to get my movie made and get my movie seen today, right? So I don't have a problem with the American dream, but there is a dark side to the American dream. And I think that's what this story is. You know, at the core, I saw it as a film about family, right? That was the one root theme of the film. It's about family and family relationships and siblings specifically, right? But it is also examining that dark side of the American dream of how greed can overtake someone, which has happened many, many times in a lot of the films I you know, love, like say the Wall Street, right, or Goodfellas, right, or Dog Day Afternoon, right. It's like, you know, what people do when they get desperate for money and want to, you know, achieve a certain status symbol and the cost of that kind of mentality, you know. So that's what the film's trying to explore. It's really examining that dark of the American dream up close, you know, in an unflinching way.
Absolutely. Yeah, so I know. I mean,
that's why I guess it stuck. You know, that's why I guess it stuck. It looked like it almost was going to change a couple times because I think there was that documentary on Netflix called American Murder. I thought we might lose our title and I'd have to change it and have many very good backups. But fortunately, they let us keep it. So,
there you skated in. It's funny. In my career as a journalist, I've reported on things like multi-level marketing schemes, which are often accused of being sort of pyramid schemes in terms of sales. And that also touches upon the American dream, where it's not just about people who are willing to do anything to achieve it, but people who want to believe so badly that they can kind of get suckered into things when a business or a person might seem too good to be true or is promising too much. But there's this faith of, you know, it looks good, so I would like to believe it, that I think also feeds into allowing con men to prey upon people in a way that, you know, is not necessarily uniquely American, but certainly kind of touches upon some of our kind of culture of sort of wanting to believe that, like, yes, this guy is for real, or this business that says I'm going to make all this money is for real.
Right. Right. You know, because that's where the term con man, confidence trickster comes from. They prey on your confidence. They get under, you know, and they're convincing. You know, that's the thing. It's, yeah.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Hey, I'm Jamie.
And I'm Justina.
And we're the hosts of Just So You Know, a podcast where we get to the bottom of suspicious stories and outright lies we're being told by companies that profit off of animals.
You think Elon Musk is shady? Wait until you hear our episode about his sinister brain experiments.
First he ruined Twitter, now he's coming for your actual brain.
No.
We've also got one about that time I stormed the runway at New York Fashion Week to protest Coach's leather handbags.
Yeah, I heard they weren't happy about that.
I couldn't tell you. They're not talking to me at the moment.
And we're just getting started. In the coming weeks, we're going to blow the lid off of everything from shady pet dealers to monkeys held hostage by coconut milk companies to the astonishing secret behind the no animals were harmed message you see at the end of movies.
And so much more. We'll hope you join us for this surprisingly fun journey full of strange characters, secretive companies, and a whole world of stuff they really don't want you to know.
Subscribe to Just So You Know wherever you get your podcasts and look for our new episodes every Thursday. Just So You Know is a PETA production.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, activities, excursions, and more in one place to make your trip truly unforgettable. Viator has over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from. Everything from simple tours to extreme adventures and all the niche, interesting stuff in between. So you can plan something that everyone you're traveling with will enjoy. Real traveler reviews give the inside scoop from people who've already been on the experiences you're considering, so you can plan with confidence. Free cancellation helps you plan for the unexpected, and 24/7 customer support means you can travel worry-free. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.
If you could somehow run into Brown if he got arrested next year and you just got the opportunity, would there be any like one question you definitely want to ask him, having studied him so extensively?
That's another good question. You know, I haven't been asked that one. I've been asked, if Brown called you, would you turn him in? Someone asked me that at the Newport Beach Film Festival. And I said, if he calls me, I'll let you know what happens. I'll let you know what I do. But I have no plan. I probably would, though. Or at least I would tell the cops. I'd be scared. If I got to meet Brown, you know, I gotta say, I don't want to give you a lame answer, but I don't know that I would. I mean, I spent so much time with this story, this character, this movie. You know, when you make a movie, you really, when you write and direct one, you kind of see it through all these different phases. I've seen the film now many, many times with audiences packed, you know, I've seen it with packed theaters and around the world. I saw it in Italy. I saw it in Boston. I saw it here. I saw it in LA. I saw it down in San Diego last week where we got an award. So I've seen the movie now so many times with people, and in making it, you see it so many times in the script. You see, you know, you see it so many times in your head. So, you know, at this point, no, I would not really ask him any questions, because I feel like for me, they've been pretty answered. I'd be curious to see like what happened or where he went in the years he was gone, possibly if he was caught. But no, I wouldn't ask him too much about it. Like I would, you know, I guess I'd be curious to hear his thoughts on the movie if he saw it, and I'm sure he'd have notes, you know. But yeah, no, I don't know. The movie for me, at least in terms of my journey making it, feels pretty closed. Like I feel like I came full circle and did what I wanted to do, told the story I wanted to tell, you know, got to do with this amazing cast. You know, I think the actor who plays Jason Derrick Brown, Tom Pelfrey from Ozark and other shows, is really just gives a tour de force performance in this. And I think he got to the core of it. And yeah, no, I feel pretty good about it all. And if you wanted to talk to me, I'd say please don't.
Sounds like you've had enough of Mr. Brown for now, at least.
I think so. You know, I think so. I don't see a sequel, but I have had it's nice to have people ask you if there's going to be one. That's a compliment, but you know, I think it's a pretty closed story personally.
Absolutely. Why do you think we are so interested in stories about people like Brown? I mean, so many people are interested in true crime, obviously, but you know, Brown represents something where it's, you know, somebody who was a con right. man who then, you know, took a life. I mean, just kind of reprehensible acts. But why do we want to know about this guy, I guess?
Well, you know, I think it's always the big question whenever you set out, certainly to make a movie, is it's like, why are you telling this story? What, like, you know, why this person? Right, why this? And I mean, in terms of Brown specifically, you know, I think the paradox is certainly what attracted me personally. The paradox of here's this guy who could be seen one way, right? As, you know, by so many people as this successful, cool, fun, loving guy, and be capable of something so evil and calculating and sociopathic. So you have those two things that I think make for a great character. And I also think, again, the theme of family. We often go to movies, theater, plays, drama, right? Because we like conflict, right? Entertainment, right? It often comes from conflict. And, you know, there's a really great conflict in this movie, you know, of the family. Like, what did they do about him? What would you do if that was your brother staying at your house? Right. And he had just done this thing that you had no idea about. Or what would you do if that was your son? The son you can't quite straighten out, which there is lesser. This is an extreme version of that. There's a little, you know, right. Every family, you know, has its dysfunctions. So, I mean, there are some that don't, but I think even those probably have something, right? Every family has drama, dysfunction. You know, I come from an Italian Jewish family, which means lots of passion and volatility, but we all love each other. But, you know, it's a great family. But, you know, I think every family has that. So I think we come to these stories because we see parts of ourselves there. You know, it helps us understand things about our world and our culture. So, you know, I think that these stories, all kinds of stories, but these stories specifically have value. And, you know, the shock or the, you know, appeal of, like, you know, let's say in our movie, we really, you know, to sell the film, right? We talk about the manhunt, right? It's, you know, Felipe trying to catch Pelfrey, right? It's Jason pitted against Lysing in this cat and mouse game. And I love that stuff too. I mean, Heat's one of my favorite movies, where it's like, you know, Pacino versus De Niro. Like, we come to the movies for that kind of thing. But, you know, we have a term in Hollywood called Trojan horse, right? Where you kind of, that's the Trojan horse. Underneath that is a message, a question, something more sophisticated. And in this case, it's, you know, a story about family and the dark side of the American dream, but it's also about, you know, a manhunt and all that. So I think there's a lot we come for. I think we come to the movies, or we listen to podcasts, or we read books, you know, to see ourselves, to make horror of the world we live in, to ask questions, see the world through a different set of eyes. Like, how often do you get to see the world through Jason Derek Brown's eyes? Well, if you rent this movie or go see it in a theater, you'll get to. And how often do you get to see Jason Derek Brown get pitted against FBI agent? Well, if you come see it, you'll get to. And I think you come out feeling, I like when movies, books, anything, art makes me feel a variety of emotions. You know, for me, I think a lot of true crime can veer very heavily, and crime in general can veer very heavily into like the overly self-serious, you know, like macabre this. And like part of what I think is fun about our movie that we're talking about today is there's some heavy stuff in there for sure. It's a tragedy at the core, but there's also moments there I've been in theaters where people laugh their asses off for the first 20 minutes, you know, when they see Jason doing his things and his performance. So, you know, the movie has humor, it has tragedy, it has sex, it has violence, it has, you know, melodrama, has all of it for you. And so that's why I like to go to the movies, because I like to feel a lot, you know, I'm an emotional person. So when I go to a film, I sit down in a dark room or on my couch, and I just, you know, I surrender myself to the movie. And I think if you come to American Murderer, I think you might have a really good time.
Absolutely. Has working on this changed anything about how you think about true crime or crimes or anything like that?
Man, you're good, dude. I haven't gotten any of your questions before. I'm not gonna lie, I'm on a bit of a script, but you really you have smart ones. Yeah. Does it change how I look at true crime? You know, I mean, I'm still in the genre, so I like it. And I gotta tell you, one thing I love about true crime as a writer, because I know a lot of writers get writer's block, but the fact is, if you write true crime, you have no excuse, because there's always something to write about. You know, I just wrote a script about, I'm writing a script right now about a bank robber who was a stockbroker that became a bank robber in Long Island. You know, it was just like, you know, writing is always at that time when it starts to get hard, and it's like you're 50 pages in, you're like, I don't know if I can keep going. But I was like, well, I know he robs another bank, so I'll just write another bank robbery. What I love about the genre is that, you know, A, there's endless stories to tell. You know, there's always some kind of drama and conflict there. And I think there's all kinds of great opportunities to tell cool stories that haven't been told yet. Because just when I think I've like found the max, I'm like, oh my God, yeah, I have like four or five right now. I'm like, I hear of three more. Like, I just heard of one yesterday on American Greed, where there's like a guy who was posing as like an Oscar winning sound engineer in Hollywood and using that to rip people up. And I'm like, that sounds awesome. I'd see that movie, you know? Or I see another one with like a sting operation of like some guy and girlfriend who wanted to kill his ex-wife. I'm like, that would be great. You know, and like these undercover cops are like working them. I mean, there's just so much out there to see. And I don't know that I'll only do true crime. That's not my plan. I hope to do a variety of movies, but I really love the genre because I think ultimately it's about, you ask what draws us to it, I think it's character. Because I think that's anytime you hear a good true crime story, whether it's a con artist, a murderer, a serial, you know, whatever it is, I think ultimately what draws you there is the people, you know? Like in this case, I think in American Murderer, Jason Derek Brown's just fascinating. I think in the case of Dahmer and why so many people watch it is that Dahmer's repugnant and scary, but he's not uninteresting, you know? He is... You know, and by the way, why did we love The Sopranos or Breaking Bad? You know, the two best TV shows of all time, arguably. Like, yeah, you probably don't want to root for these guys. You probably shouldn't root for these guys, but you may find yourself, even though you shouldn't. And that's kind of the fun and the appeal of that kind of genre, that kind of storytelling. So, yeah, no, I'm not sure how much it's changed my perception of true crime. I'm grateful to how popular the genre is, you know, and that so many people out there, I'm learning from going on your podcast and other true crime podcasts, you know, how many people are interested. I kind of thought it was just me, you know, and like a few other people, but it's really interesting to see how many people love these kinds of stories. So, yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of us out there. And I'm curious in terms of, you kind of gave us a few hints already, but I'll ask, you know, any other hints about future projects around true crime or other people looking into?
I could tell you, yeah, no, I'm right now working on my second film. It's called The Socialite. And it's based on a book, a true crime book, actually. by an author named Carrie Drobin, who you should totally have on your podcast someday. I can see you two gelling. She's written a lot of true crime books about like actually outlaw biker gangs, all kinds of things. But this story was particularly fascinating. It's a Aspen socialite who orchestrated her ex-husband's murder in 1996. But he was blown up by a car bomb. The movie is about her and her psyche and her character and another kind of dark side of the American dream tale. I'm really excited about that one. I have another one about a kidnapping in Texas that I'm really excited about. I have another one, this bank robber one I told you about. And there's also another good bank robbing one, set in Seattle in the 90s that I really enjoy, that I'm still very much in the weeds on. But yeah, I'm getting kind of all these scripts into shape as, you know, movie 2, 3, 4, and 5. So,
well, we'll be looking forward to talking about those. Hopefully you can come back and chat about those someday. Oh,
absolutely. You've got me. So yeah, if you want to be on part of my press tour, you're welcome anytime.
There you go. Awesome. Well, listen, thank you so much for this. Where can people watch American Murderer?
Yes. So American Murderer, you can see it now. It'll be on streaming, on digital and demand. It also might be in a theater near you if you want to come see it on the big screen. But in terms of streaming, digital and demand, you can see it on the iTunes store, Amazon, Apple TV, really anywhere you can rent a movie, cable, DirecTV, all those platforms. So anywhere you can rent a film, you can rent it. And if you like it, please rate it and rate it on IMDb, Letterboxd, Rotten Tomatoes, wherever you rate movies. And please tell people to come see it because, you know, we have a really great cast, but we are an indie film. This is a labor of love for a lot of people. And so if we want to keep seeing more true crime movies like this, please come out, watch the movie, rank it, tell your friends, tell everyone, tell all your true crime buddies to check it out, because it helps a movie like this, you know, get awareness. You know, so thank you. And thank you so much for having me on. Oh, and also, if you want to follow me on anything, you follow me on Instagram at Matthew L. Gentile, or you can go on my website, MatthewGentileDirector.com. I update it pretty frequently. And you can write me there if you want to write me a note what you thought about the movie.
Awesome. Well, Matthew, thank you so much for this great conversation. We really appreciated having you on, and yeah, really appreciate your insights on all of this. Is there anything I didn't ask you about? This is my razzle dazzle question. Anything I didn't ask you about that you wanted to mention or, you know, discuss?
No, this was a really great conversation. I think you asked amazing questions. So good on you for doing such good research. And yeah, no, you're a very good interviewer.
Thank you. I tried.
This was a great interview. One of my favorites. So thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much to Matthew for an insightful conversation. We really appreciated it.
Thanks so much for listening to The Murder Shade. If you have a tip concerning one of the cases we cover, please email us at murdersheet@gmail.com. If you have actionable information about an unsolved crime, please report it to the appropriate authorities.
If you're interested in joining our Patreon, that's available at www.patreon.com/murdersheet. If you want to tip us a bit of money for records requests, you can do so at www.buymeacoffee.com/murdersheet. We very much appreciate any support.
Special thanks to Kevin Tyler Greenlee, who composed the music for The Murder Sheet, and who you can find on the web at kevintg.com.
If you're looking to talk with other listeners about a case we've covered, you can join the Murder Sheet discussion group on Facebook. We mostly focus our time on research and reporting, so we're not on social media much. We do try to check our email account, but we ask for patience as we often receive a lot of messages. Thanks again for listening.
You know how to book flights and hotels. All you're missing is a tool to plan the travel experiences you'll have once you arrive. That's why you need Viator. Book guided tours, excursions, and more in one place. There are over 300,000 travel experiences to choose from, so you can find something for everyone. And Viator offers free cancellation and 24/7 customer support for worry-free travel. Download the Viator app now and use code Viator10 for 10% off your first booking in the app. Find travel experiences for you. Do more with Viator.